Now time for a catch-up on stories making headlines across the world on this week's World Report with Christopher McKevitt.
Good morning. On today's programme, we'll hear from Zimbabwe, where some voters looking to cast their ballot in last week's elections found their polling stations closed. And we'll hear from Nashville in the US, where sold-out concerts are not music to everyone's ears. But first to India, where on Wednesday history was made when it became the first country to successfully land a spacecraft on the south pole of the moon. And they did it for the relatively cheap price of $75 million. India now joins the US, China and Russia in the elite club of lunar exploring nations. Shalu Yadav has more from Delhi.
Millions of Indians have grown up listening to rhymes about the moon. I vividly remember watching a Bollywood film song from the 1950s, where a mother is singing a lullaby to her son. It starts with telling him how far the moon is and that one day he could go there in a flying cot. The song referred to the moon as Chanda Mama, which literally translates as moon uncle. And ever since, children in India have made the moon their honorary uncle. Cut to 2023. Not only is the moon within reach for India, the country has almost shocked the world with its capability to land on the south pole of the moon, something that even developed nations have not managed to achieve so far. All eyes were on India, as last week a similar Russian mission, Luna 25, failed to make a landing on this elusive spot of the moon. The South Pole is a region of crucial interest to scientists, as it is believed to be a reservoir of frozen water. Scientists say that this water ice could sustain humanity by supplying fuel, oxygen and drinking water for future missions. A lot was at stake for India when it announced its second attempt to reach the moon, a chance at making space history and also proving to the world that it is a major league space player. Indian Space Research Organization, or ISRO, had made a similar attempt in 2019, which failed. But much before that, ISRO had proved its mettle with its first moon mission named Chandrayaan-1, which was the first to find evidence of water on the moon back in 2008. August 23rd last week was a window into the rare moment in India when the entire nation was glued to their television and mobile screens with bated breath. Such scenes are seen only during cricket tournament finals when India is playing to get the trophy. Prayers were being offered in temples, mosques and churches in anticipation for the mission's success. And the prayers were answered. Celebrations erupted all over the country as the lander and rover made a soft landing. India is on the moon, announced Mr. Somnath, the chairman of ISRO. Indian Prime Minister, who was watching the mission from South Africa on the sidelines of the BRICS summit, congratulated the scientists and called it an achievement not only for India, but all of humanity. He said that the landing is going to change the way the world looks at India, and the country is not going to stop here. It now plans to send a human to the space next. What also stood out was how cost-effective India's moon mission is. It cost less than $75 million, making it one of the cheapest lunar missions globally. For context, that's much less than the budget of the Hollywood space blockbuster Gravity. Analysts say that these missions are a part of India's wider ambitions of becoming a low-cost space power. And it also wants to show to the world that its space programs are independent and indigenous, made and executed by Indian scientists, something that the country is really proud of. Even as there's a huge element of national pride attached to its space programs, India has also developed a reputation for being a global destination for affordable satellite launches. Over the next 2 weeks, the Vikram lander and Pragyan rover will carry out experiments on the moon's surface, including deriving its chemical and mineralogical composition to further understand the South Pole region of the moon. And this data will work as a gateway for future exploration of deep space, opening a whole new world of possibilities. For World Report, this is Shalu Yadav in Delhi.
Zimbabwe held its presidential and parliamentary elections on Wednesday, but when voters got to some polling stations, they were closed while others had no ballot papers. A regional observer mission has now taken the unprecedented step of saying Zimbabwe's vote fell short of regional guidelines, provoking an angry response from the government. From Harare, Ryan Truscott has this report.
There's a rhythm to elections in Zimbabwe, especially ones that the ruling ZANU-PF party is expected to win, which is, in fact, just about all the elections since independence in 1980. The rhythm goes like this. Get up early, put on warm clothes, head to the polling station. You might even take a blanket if it's winter. Wait in the polling queues for hours. Edge closer to the polling tent. When you get to the table where you check your name, hold your breath as it may not be there. Vote if you can. Look at the purple stain on your little finger that proves you've voted. Go home. Wait for the results to be announced by the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission. Entertain a brief moment of hope, if you support the main opposition party, when urban votes go mostly to them. Be brought back to reality when the rural votes start being announced and almost all go to the ruling party. Elections this Wednesday looked like they would go entirely according to script. The playing field was, in many ways, as skewed as ever. Incentives have been updated to chicken and chips by ruling party rally holders, but the principle remains the same. Loyalties can be bought or retained in Zimbabwe through history, propaganda, or fear, often a combination of the three. Except somehow, this time, the script didn't follow the normal pattern. First, the delays. Delays in opening of polling stations aren't unheard of, an hour or two in some places. The Zimbabwe Electoral Commission said that by 10 a.m., 3 hours after the start of polling, only 23% of stations in Harare were open. Reports started to come in of five-hour delays, six. Then there were polling stations like ones in Harare's Hague Park, where ballot papers arrived 9 hours late. The commission had to extend voting by a second day in 40 wards, meaning that voters, if they still felt up to voting after one wasted day, had to return for part of Thursday. And while President Mnangagwa said on Twitter that the extension showed his government's commitment to inclusivity and democratic ideals, critics noted that the lack of ballot papers had also occurred in opposition strongholds. In what was starting to feel increasingly bizarre, voters were still queuing to cast their ballots on Thursday, while results from other polling stations began to be announced. And for the first time in many people's memories, there was no longer that split between early wins for the opposition, followed by a slew of massive wins in the ruling party's rural strongholds. This time the announcements of results were mixed, one for the main opposition Triple C party, followed by one for ZANU-PF. Were the delays a result of massive incompetence on the part of an elections management body not known for its agility? Or was this part of a new ZANU-PF strategy to cling on to power? Opposition leader Nelson Chamisa, a feisty 45-year-old lawyer and preacher who was once the right-hand man of the late Morgan Tsvangirai, said the delays were a clear sign of voter suppression. But he too has been sending out mixed messages, proclaiming victory and the sovereignty of God on Twitter by midday on Thursday. The Elections Commission has 5 days to announce the results, but chances of independently verifying them were dashed late on Wednesday when police raided the offices of respected local observer groups, the Zimbabwe Election Support Network and the Election Resource Centre, carting off 41 of their employees and volunteers in full view of international observers. That may have been one provocation too many. On Friday, the regional SADC observer mission said the polls had fallen short of the bloc's guidelines on elections. That rare criticism from Zimbabwe's own neighbours stung Mnangagwa's government, which hit out at SADC observer head Nevers Mumba. On Saturday, while shoppers headed out to stores in well-heeled suburbs, unidentified men raided an opposition press conference and police issued an arrest warrant for opposition spokesman Promise Mkhwananzi. Tensions are rising and few, including in ZANU-PF, appear to be entirely sure of the script they're following this time round. For World Report, I'm Ryan Truscott in Harare, Zimbabwe.
Vegas without the casinos. That's how Nashville is starting to look, with hotels springing up everywhere, music blaring around the clock, packed out stadiums and concert venues headlining stars like Beyoncé and Ed Sheeran. But is it all happening at the expense of the interests of local residents? Isabel Conway went to Nashville to find out.
What has Davy Crockett, the legendary frontiersman, got in common with Nashville royalty like Dolly Parton, Taylor Swift, or country and western superstar Garth Brooks? As it so happens, the king of the wild frontier was Nashville's first music celebrity, known far and wide for his fiddle playing. The earliest settlers celebrated with fiddle tunes and buck dancing after safely disembarking on the shores of the Cumberland River back in the late 1700s. They built a rowdy trading hub where Crockett, an exceptional musician, would draw big crowds to hear him play. History also tells us that the town was on its way to becoming a national centre for music publishing as the 1800s unfolded. Nashville's ties in the past with country music, lyrics that elevated workaday angst to the heights of heroic suffering all about unrequited love, rivalry, loss, forgiveness and redemption, has expanded into most genres of popular music in America's top party town. Music City is fast becoming Vegas without the casinos, according to some, arguing that non-stop tourism growth is at the expense of local community interests. The city's ever-developing skyline, still dominated by the black pointy-eared skyscraper nicknamed Batman, is punctuated by dozens of cranes as ever more high-end hotels, restaurants, shopping outlets and music venues spring up. Showing me around the city's most iconic historic landmark, world-renowned Ryman Auditorium, former home of the Grand Ole Opry, the radio show that popularised country music launched the careers of numerous stars and is still going strong. Christy Driver jokes, we're called Crane City. I never thought I'd see Nashville and luxury used in one sentence, she says. Downtown used to be full of sex shops, peep shows and loan shark dives. Now, every time I go into the city, it's unrecognisable. There's that much change and development going on. And a dedicated police unit keeps Honky Tonk Highway safe day and night. Musical energy literally bounces off the walls of dozens of bars, half of them owned by country music stars that pump free live music onto the streets. The venues going up three floors with a different band on each are packed solid, pretty much around the clock. In the blistering August heat, when temperatures are hitting 100 degrees, the whirring fans inside turn up the volume, and in one bar, the waitress is handing out earplugs. Broadway teems with visitors in Stetsons and cowboy boots, and on a busy intersection, former school buses converted into mobile party vehicles trundle past, and pedal bars weighed down by singing bachelorettes parade by. One of the go-to vacation destinations in the world, whose economy is driven by tourism, Nashville's post-pandemic boom is now in danger of creating the kind of over-tourism that has beset other top visitor attractions globally. A long-time resident was quoted recently in local media saying, "Everyone's poured jet fuel on Nashville as the most fun place to visit. Now that it's on fire, there's a concern." Nashville is currently in the process of electing a new mayor. Frontrunner, who won the first round earlier this month, Democrat Freddie O'Connell, campaigned for a halt on toys for tourists. Give Nashville back to Nashvillians, he urged on his pre-election TV advertisements. No friend of developers, the progressive computer science engineer champions immigrant integration and the environment. He was the only Nashville councillor to oppose a planned $2.1 billion National Football League stadium for the Tennessee Titans, build a massive future visitor attraction. That money should be spent instead on city services, public transportation, alternatives to cars, and laying thousands of miles of vital sidewalks to keep pedestrians safe for exercise, walking the dog, and accessing schools and shops, O'Connell says. A mayoral runoff between Freddie O'Connell and his nearest rival, Alice Rowley, a prominent Republican and business strategist, will be held next month. The record young turnout in voting for the next mayor of Nashville is credited to superstar Taylor Swift, who was urging her followers on Instagram to do their civic duty and make their voices heard to transform their city for the better. Nashville operates zero income tax. Dependence on tourism as well as the booming conference sector, buoyed by sales tax and other forms of indirect taxation, are pivotal to the city's economic health and growth. Beyond music, Nashville boasts the Frist World-Class Art Museum, housed in the city's former main post office, an outstanding Art Deco building. The museum's marketing director, Kathy Diemenbrunn, stresses, it's about getting the balance right, making sure we aren't just spending on things tourists want at the expense of local needs. Are we getting it right, I ask? Well, she answers, we're working towards that, but it's a balance between our very successful tourism and marketing industries and meetings and taking care of local needs and issues. For World Report, I'm Isabel Conway in Nashville, Tennessee.
Well, that's it from World Report today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin and Lisa Pereira. If you want to listen back to the programme, you can go to rte.ie/worldreport or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Christopher McKevitt, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.